Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Philip McKenzie. I'm an anthropologist strategist with a focus on culture and humanity-centered design. I'm Brooklyn-born and Brooklyn-made. Every week, I will bring you guests from a wide variety of backgrounds who, despite their different areas of expertise, share traits in common. They aim high, push boundaries, and make things happen. Their experiences drive insights. On today's episode of The Deep Dive, I'm joined by Lauren Benton. She is the author of They Called It Peace, Worlds of Imperial Violence. She's the Barton M. Biggs Professor of History at Yale University and a recipient of the Toynbee Prize for significant contributions to global history. This is a great read. She's the author of several other books, but I won't mention all of them right here. We're here to talk about They Called It Peace, Worlds of Imperial Violence. And I want to welcome Lauren to the show. Welcome to The Deep Dive. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks so much for having me.
It's ironic in my mind to think they called it peace, but yet we're talking about violence. And that's been a very interesting, I think, juxtaposition that's run throughout the entire book. And although it is steeped in history, particularly telling like a European sort of story of empire, I find that the parallels to our current world are so striking. And that was one of the reasons why I really wanted to tackle this. So there's so much in the book. So I want to start with really some definitional things, because I think you do a really good job of setting up some key distinctions when we talk about the type of imperial violence that you highlight. And small wars is something that I think is central to the theme. So I want to give you an opportunity to answer a couple of things. I'm going to put them all together and you can jump in wherever you choose. You know, why did you want to tackle this particular topic around this type of the history of this type of imperial violence? Why the term small wars, and why do small wars matter?
Well, thanks. Those are great questions. I want to start with really the question of why I wanted to write this. And it does grow equally out of my own observations about current affairs and my knowledge of history simultaneously. We have this narrative about global violence that goes something like this. There was just a lot of it, and it was very unruly. And then in the 19th and the 20th century, in the West in particular, we came up with these laws of the rules of laws of war and international charged international institutions with containing warfare. So that's a pretty optimistic scenario. It suggests that we're on our way to regulating war in some fashion. And I realized that what it means is that it gives us very few tools for understanding these global hotspots at the present, because they then tend to look like wars that have just bubbled up in the interstices of the international order, almost by mistake. And I wanted to just turn that around and think about small violence as a kind of ubiquitous phenomenon in the world. And then instead of thinking about how we have sought to regulate war, really start with the violence itself and look at the way that it is ordered, how it occurs in patterns, how people act to justify it and structure it. And my subject is this long period of expansion of European empires from 1500 to 1900. But I think out of that story, you get a very different perspective on small wars today. We tend to use the term now to mean in a couple of ways, besides, you know, these sort of things that we can't contain because they're kind of mistakes in the international order. We also use the term small wars today to refer to what analysts call asymmetric warfare, conventional armies fighting against guerrilla or other unconventional forces. And I also wanted to open up that definition. And so, as I say, talk about in the introduction to the book, I'm very happy to operate with a very flexible definition to include all kinds of acts of violence, sometimes classed as war, but often not classed as war, raiding, captive taking, limited armed interventions, and the like. And I begin with that as my material and then start to see how those patterns of violence actually were constituting global order and not just accidents against our attempts to limit war.
You know, you mentioned this notion of a mistake. And I wanted to spend some time with that kind of language because, again, as a layman, you know, I'm not deeply studied in these issues as much as you are, but also I think more studied than most in the sense that I'm a highly leveraged layman. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. For both personal interests and professional interests, I do get an opportunity to talk to wonderful scholars like yourself. But you know, when I kind of use that lens and I look out on the world, I see this idea of a mistake being often used as a justification for conflict, whether direct conflict or supporting of conflict, right? This idea of, particularly the United States, so I'll kind of use that lens that we're always like the reluctant warriors, right? Like we're not, you know, I would see, you know, someone like a Biden on TV or someone who speaks for him, and to always parrot the same line, like, you know, we don't want to do this, you know, like, this is not what we want. Like, we don't start wars, like, we're America, right? Like, but, you know, we somehow got pulled into this, or we don't want to escalate this. We want to de-escalate this. How did this happen? I don't know, but here we are, right? So that language seems to be constant. So I want to give you an opportunity to comment on it, because as much as, yes, it can seem like something that's happening today, I think you make very good points within the book that this is actually something that exists as a way empire structures, right? This notion of stumbling into wars that they didn't intend to.
That's right. One of the findings of the book is that justifications are being made in ad hoc ways pretty continuously as empires are engaging in violence, responding in violent ways to indigenous communities. And they are, I trace in the book the way that a lot of the commentary about violence really focuses on this question of how do we limit it? Both how do we justify it in terms of creating order and returning to peace, which is a common, as you point out, common theme and justifications for violence. And also, how do we limit it? How do we keep small wars small? How do we keep violence, I call it violence, at the threshold of war and peace? How do we talk about it, define it, and create space for it, legal space for it, political space for it? Because there are sort of two, I would say, big findings in this regard in the book. One is that over this long history, there was a lot of tolerance and officially and legally constructed tolerance for a continual drumbeat of small violence in empires. So there is this kind of steady state, a kind of perpetual state of war, interrupted by unstable bouts of peace. So that's sort of one big message. Another is that the attempts to limit war, tragically, paradoxically, end up setting up the conditions for atrocities to occur. And I trace how that happens in early empires, in conquests that are organized as series of raids that often lead to spectacular massacres. And I explain the kind of logic and sequencing of those events. And it happens later in settler colonial contexts and other contexts where imperial forces are charged with protecting imperial subjects. And they turn from that supposedly contained small violence to these enormous campaigns of dispossession and even extermination.
Colonial settler, we can't use these words anymore, right? Aren't those on the banned list?
You know, I'm glad you asked that, because one of the things that has been on my mind lately, because there is all of this really politically charged debate in the atmosphere about settler colonialism. And I really would hope that people in reading this book and others could kind of take a step back from the way these terms are being used, sometimes in a kind of cartoonish fashion. And instead of thinking about settler colonialism as this one thing connected to this one scenario of extreme violence, really look a little bit more in detail at the history, at how violence unfolded. I am not denying that violence was there. In fact, it's the whole point of the book to say that it was. But I do think there's something to be gained from understanding the evolution of these steps of violence, of these pathways that take you from limited violence to atrocities. I think they're helpful for understanding the present, and it's a little less helpful to just kind of bandy these terms around as if they, you know, we all know what they mean.
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously I'm just being a little facetious here. We can use anywhere we want on this show. Like that's the beauty of it, right? Like we are fully engaged with using language and defining it in the manner in which it was intended. And I think it gives us, you know, these are the important things that gives an opportunity, right? To the more you do engage with work like yours and with many others, you realize how absurd those who wish to critique the use of these words actually is, because they do not know what they're talking about.
And they that are is true.
What I call politely bad faith actors. My commentary, you know, my editorial, people who listen to the show know that exactly who I'm talking about when I talk about bad faith actors, right? But you highlighted a lot of things that are really important, but, you know, because I'm following my notes, I want to emphasize this notion of rule of law and this idea of also containment, right? That using structure of law, and that's always shifting, you know, kind of the histories of what the Spanish considered a rule of law, which is very much tied to the Catholic Church, and what other later imperial powers like the British, the French, the Germans, and America, and so on and so forth, the rule of law is always shifting. But what really stuck out to me in the larger context is whose law is the law that we are really asking to guide us, which might seem like a simple question, but again, putting that layman hat on, I'm always curious about that, right? I think people would consider the UN and the international courts as law, right? But the more we also look at some of that stuff, we realize, well, it's law only if you're allowed to by certain larger imperial powers, the United States being one of them, right? With incredible veto power over anything that the UN can do, right? So I'm curious about how do we think about law, and whose law are we really expected to contain these small wars?
Well, that's a great question, or set of questions. One of the things that I try to do in my work in general, and I also try to do in this book, because I have a background, I'm a historian, I also have a background in anthropology, and I hang out with a lot of lawyers and legal historians too. But my perspective on law is a bit different, I think, from the view that others might think of when they just come to the topic of law. I want us to think about law as something broader and more flexible and more cultural, in effect, in the ways that it's influencing social relations. And of course, that's a bit easier, I think, for me to convey in looking at historical materials than it is at the present. Because in these, one of the points that I develop in the book is the notion that interpolitical relations and these patterns of violence are not just being regulated by Europeans and narrated as law by Europeans. Communities across the world have a sense of law and justice when it comes to violence. And what's really interesting to me is that there's a lot more intercultural communication around these themes than we might have thought. You know, there's a kind of old story about cultural clash of cultures where you imagine European empires arriving and indigenous people just don't understand what's happening to them and, you know, brute force is being exercised on them. And really what one of the things I try to do in the book is show that there's a lot of mutual intelligibility about these routines of violence. It's not to say that they're any less tragic for the victims of violence, but often they are being very strategic about their responses and making their own legal arguments. So indigenous communities, for example, will represent themselves as autonomous and as capable and having the authority to make peace and to make peace treaties in some moments. And in other moments, they might be willing to sign truces that will say that they are a subordinate power because they see that as a possibility for, you know, gaining some stability and protecting lives and property. And I don't want to regard that as not a strategic choice. I think often it was. And I think we have to really sort of change our ideas about what law is. So I view law as kind of coming out of these relationships, being affected by these conflicts, being created by these conflicts, and the way they're talked about by people on all sides, and not as something that's a sort of set of norms and legislation that's being kind of carted around in people's suitcases. And I think it's an interesting perspective. At least I hope it works in the book.
It definitely does. And it actually, in my reading of the book, afforded a sort of sense of agency. Many communities, indigenous communities that I'll highlight the most, where, like you said, the violence is often enacted, right? But they are also capable of many things, self-defense, capable of strategy, as you highlighted. And to me, as you know, one person's opinion, it fleshed out a story that is, I think, often told to make one group seem like victims only, rather than something other than victims. But I wanted to expand on this notion of the cultural part of the conversation. The culture cues and the misunderstanding as many of these forces kind of came together was something that really jumped out at me. And I wanted to get your sense of how do you distinguish that sort of first contact culture cues and misunderstandings that can lead to these small wars and plunder that you highlight in the book. How is that different, if it's different, from what we would call, I think, in a more modern military parlance, this fog of war? You know, Robert McNamara famously used that term. You know, there's a very good documentary, kind of one-on-one interview with him called Fog of War. So I'm curious, in your mind, are there distinctions in those two sort of areas of befuddlement?
Well, I like to begin from a premise that's slightly different from the usual premise. So the usual premise is one of, as you said, kind of lack of understanding, lack of communication about, you know, strange violence. No one understands what the other party is doing. This is not just something that an idea that persists in the present. It was also historically produced this notion, we don't understand what these other people are doing, why they're fighting in the way that they're fighting. But what happens when you look at the actual practices of violence is that, in fact, there's a tremendous amount of intelligibility across these things. So, for example, I take up the question of raiding early in the book. I cannot find, I'm sure there are some, but it's difficult to find places in the early modern world where they're unfamiliar with raiding. Raids were happening almost everywhere, and they were not just an event. They also had generated certain expectations about dangers and how to avoid them. So one of the things I point out about these raids, which accumulate and come in waves and turn into, in many cases, campaigns of conquest, is that they also came with alongside demands for surrender. So if you're raiding a lot and you are gaining military superiority over your nearby enemies, at a certain point, you begin to just march up to the edge of towns and say, it would be a good idea for you to submit now, or very bad things are going to happen to you. So you have a very close connection between these raiding cultures, which, again, are ubiquitous in the early modern world. They're not just European, and it's not just Europeans who are doing this. And what that means is that other people, Europeans and others, are very aware of the severe consequences of a failure to submit. And this kind of threat, you must submit or we are really going to punish you in spectacular ways, was something that many indigenous communities understood extremely well. They also had raiding histories. They knew how raids worked and how demands for surrender and capitulation worked. And so I guess I would respond to your question by just turning it around just a little bit. I think it's helpful to begin not from the premise of the fog of war, not from the premise that this is strange violence, but from a kind of willingness to see ways in which violence is quotidian, kind of built into people's social and cultural experiences, and already in their knowledge base before often they're put in these situations.
And I think that's a point well taken. But even within the concept of raiding, and I want to get to also plunder as a part of it, because you do make a distinction between those two things. I'm going to introduce something not where the book doesn't spend a lot of time on this, but the notion of slavery, for example, mm-hmm. right? You know, again, kind of using modern day parlance, a lot of folks will look at, well, those who seem, in my mind, to minimize the effect of the transatlantic slave trade and its effect on both Africa and those in the Western Hemisphere and throughout the diaspora, will often use an argument, and I'm simplifying, but it will go mm-hmm. something like this. Slavery is something that existed throughout history. Everybody was somewhat familiar. Everybody's been a slave at some point in their history. So, right, like I'm simplifying, but it does kind of really go something like that, right? Without, I think, any sort of ability to actually wrestle with the very real notion that the transatlantic slave trade was unique to the idea of slavery in many ways, right? And so, kind of putting that aside, an example. As I was reading the book, understanding that conflict is not something that is innate just to Europeans, is not just innate to, you know, Europeans did not invent violence and then import it in the rest of the world, right? But I think the notion of the reasons for the raids, when you've traveled a very precarious journey by boat, is different from raids that might happen within a cultural context. So I'm curious about your thoughts on that and sort of the long tail effect of that, so to speak.
Well, I'm very glad that you asked that question and asked it in that way, because it gives me...
Wow, I'm two for two.
It gives me an opportunity to say, you know, to highlight that even though I was just emphasizing the kind of premise that there's mutual intelligibility in the world, another theme of the book is to try to understand the ways that European global power was accumulating through violence and the kind of institutional innovations and the novel claims that they did make about their authority to make the laws of war and to regulate the laws of war. And so, you know, I think there's a way of putting these things together. And in the case of slavery, which I talk about in an unusual way in the book, because I discuss the way European empires regarded households as these key containers for captives and then imagined early colonies as collections of households, partly because they needed to construct places to put captives. And these were initially captives from nearby raiding. They were also servants and other subordinate, and then they became households, were also the containers for enslaved Africans who were transported across the Atlantic world. So how did they justify that? They, again, drew on this discourse about lawful captive taking as a punishment for the failure to submit in war, right? So it, even though you and I know, and I'm sure many of your listeners know, that the Atlantic slave trade did not involve, except peripherally, captive taking in war, that continued to be an element, but it was not the central element, particularly at the height of the trade. But Europeans continued this drumbeat of that lawful captive taking as a way of justifying what was going on. And they created institutions around that idea, the household with enslaved people in it, the plantation society with the right to protect itself from outside attack, and so on. So there is a connection between these things, but I do want to make it clear that I'm very interested in the book and the turning points and the moments in which Europeans set themselves up with claims, sometimes using this legal repertoire that I've just described, that but set themselves up as the arbiters of what was lawful in warfare and in violence in general.
You know, I found that really to be fascinating, you know, and a great bridge to when you're talking about that accumulation of wealth, which often came from human beings, you know, the capital. So we get an opportunity to talk about plunder, you know, which was one of my favorite chapters of the book, because it really introduced this circularity that I found quite interesting, that the plunder helped to build the empire, and the bigger the empire grew, the more you needed to plunder. So you get this like circular thing going on. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of talk about that circular relationship, but also maybe define plunder, because, you know, again, it sounds like something you talk, when we talk about pirates and stuff like that, right? So it's just a fun word, though, with a lot of violence underneath it, right? So again, that circular notion of plunder and maybe like, how should we think about plunder? It's not just gold in a chest, right? It's more than that.
Absolutely. And plunder really was an engine of violence in the early modern world. So it involves the taking of property, the taking of booty, and forces were looking for, in particular, movable property. Anything they could take and run with was in these raiding cultures highly valued. And they captured human beings as part of plunder. And this organized seizure of people and property, goods and people, was central to the expansion of empires in a whole variety of ways. And one of the key ways was, this was how you got people to fight for you in an empire. They were not being paid salaries, or if they were, as I discussed in some of the cases I highlight, they often didn't get paid their salaries. So you have, in one of the examples I trace, a large stranded army in Jamaica, an English army that captured the island from the Spaniards, and they're not getting paid. And so what do they do? Well, many of them turn to raiding, because plunder is for them the only way that they're going to get any benefit from being where they are. And it's officially sanctioned. So it isn't piracy. It is officially sanctioned plunder, because officials understand that this is what they also need to do, to sponsor violence in order to bring the resources into their fledgling and starving communities. And so this is organized plunder. It's not chaotic plunder. And it is, again, something that is, I call it a global regime of plunder because it is so far widespread and it is so central to the formation of empires.
I'm glad you mentioned Jamaica. I'm not Jamaican, but I am West Indian, but from better places than Jamaica. Jokes to all my Jamaicans out there. I'm not. We all tease each other when we're from the Caribbean. Every island thinks they're better than the other. But, you know, resistance has been a big part of the story of empire. And, you know, I think of, and not just in Jamaica, but in other parts of the West Indies where there was resistance, you know, people would often go into the hills. You know, Maroon communities would then develop and raid against the slaveholding institutions and others that were seeking to kind of destroy their way of life. So I'm curious about, you know, when does the raiding on the other side become a part of self-defense in these small wars? How do we highlight that or make these sort of distinctions in these spaces of incredible violence where, yes, there are going to be those on the other side who raid, who come into the towns and kind of steal, destroy, kill, whatever you want to do it, but they're also, they would say that they're the resistance, right, against those who are trying to occupy their space. So how do we calculate that as we kind of think about these small wars and conflicts?
Well, again, I want to go back to this idea that it's a good thing to think about these empires as being in a state of perpetual war. And if we sort of change our way of thinking about what order is, right? And that in itself is an order, right? It's not one we think of as orderly, but in effect, it's operating that way. And this is actually quite a I think, revealing and powerful way to think about violence in slavery. I was building here on the work of Vincent Brown, who wrote a book about slave rebellion in Jamaica, who makes this point very clearly, and some other historians, that enslaved people in households, in their enslavers' households, in the same way that enslavers thought of themselves as containing war captives within their households, and this is a justification. Enslaved people saw themselves very often, Vincent Brown suggests, as warriors in a state of war with their enslavers. They have not stopped warring with them. There are unstable peaces that occur, and Maroons are a great example of that because they escape and then strike peace agreements with plantocracies. But this gives us a different way of thinking about this kind of state of violence. Not something that order is not the absence of violence. It really is a part of the order. I hope that's helpful. It's the way I like to think about it.
It is helpful, and it just introduced a question that's not in my notes, but I think it's probably been maybe an underlying question as I read the book, and probably as I read a lot of books and things like this, like. Can an empire that's always in a state of war to some degree or have an ordered state of violence, is that a healthy way for us to conduct ourselves? I mean, this might be far afield of the book and far more philosophical, but I'm left with that as a question that's constantly on my mind, that can you exist in a healthy state of violence?
It is a treacherous way to be and to live. And I think some of these patterns are, in fact, still with us. I would say that one of the aha moments for me in working on this book came when I was writing about, or reading, I should say, about the way that truces worked. And I began to read about these truces. The example that I developed most in the book is about these series of truces and the reconquest, what used to be called the reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula by Christians. And there's just a whole series of these truces, and they are designed to be limited and to end. They are temporary truces. Sometimes they're limited by a number of years. Sometimes they're limited by the lifetime of the signers. But everyone recognizes that these are agreements of temporary peace and that they will end. And there's just this long 150-year series of on and off again truces in the lead up to the conquest of Granada. And when I was reading about that, I thought, this is really very significant because it does, in fact, point us to an understanding of these unstable moments of peace and the underlying condition of war. Is it a healthy way to live? No. Is it a treacherous way to live? It really is, because even in moments of peace, one knows that there's going to be an end to it in these places, these sorts of long phases of violence that occur in particular parts of the world and that still recur in particular parts of the world, sort of shifting global hotspots, mind you, where everybody knows that these temporary truces are going to end. And also when they end, they might end with particular force, which is another thing that I discuss in the book. So I do think that there is some of this dynamic, old as it is still with us. And I do think it has tragic dimensions. I do not know how to stop it. I wish I could conclude in the book how to stop it. What I mainly can conclude is that we can at least keep our eyes open to it and not believe people who are leading us into so-called small wars on the claim that they're going to be contained, or who are suggesting that the other side is failing to make peace, but that they are good peacemakers, right? One of the things that happens when truces fall apart is that one side accuses the other of having broken the terms of a truce. And then, as I was saying before, all bets are off on the dimensions of violence that you can use against truce breakers. Do you need very good proof that someone violated the terms of truces? You don't. Do you need new reasons to go to war? You don't, because you're just resuming a war that has been temporarily paused. So I do, in the way that you suggest, view this as a kind of very sobering and tragic history to contemplate. I hope that it would have the effect of at least opening our eyes to some of the dynamics of warfare in our own time.
Yeah, eye-opening is a hard thing to do. You know, because I don't know. I feel like when you spend a lot of time in these spaces, it's obvious. I think if you don't, like, Empire is also very good at it's like sports teams, right? Like, you're on this team, you know, and if you're not on this team, you're against me. And so I'm just blind to certain realities, right? Because I don't think most people, and I'm speaking like people here, right? Like in America, they don't consider themselves, because I've had conversations like this with other folks that have been guests of the show. And I don't think the average American thinks of themselves as being part of an empire, you know, like even to use that word in a context of discussing America's place in the world is insulting to, I think, the average run of the mill American who views America as this largely, if not good force in the world, if not good, maybe benign, but that's as far as they're willing to go, right? Like that's it. Those are the two options. We're either really good, like Captain America, literally a nation of Captain America, or we're just, you know, don't want to be bothered, but that's it, you know? So opening your eyes to violence, particularly violence done in your name, I think is hard for a lot of people to stomach.
I think that's true. I will say one of the reasons in the book that I don't talk about much about American empire is that I think people might be able to reflect more easily on the imperial history of the United States if they're reading about other places. And
Clever.
I hope so. I mean, I think in the second half of the book in particular, I highlight and trace some campaigns of violence against Indigenous Americans in South America. But the dynamics of that violence are very similar to the dynamics of and the history of what we call Indian wars in the United States. And I would hope that that would be apparent to people. I don't make it very explicit, but I do make it explicit that I do see the, a lot of the very good, very compelling recent work by U.S. historians on American history as a history of empire to be very good.
Absolutely. I mean, I can only read it with that lens, right? Like,
yeah.
I read it and I'm like, this sounds familiar, right? Or this framing, where have I read or seen this before, right? But it begs to the question around how we even engage, you know, to kind of continue with the eyes open, or dare we say woke, right? you know, notion is the realization of small wars and sort of this violence as part of the order easier to obscure when history is kind of taught through the lens of just the big wars, right? Because then you're looking at a start and a stop, you know, Archduke Ferdinand was shot in 1914, and then, you know, the Yanks are coming, and then the war ended in 1918, there was an armistice, and, you know, and then, oh, look, Hitler invaded, you know, Poland, September 1st, 1939, and boom, ended, 45, right? Like, you have these dates, and so you miss all the stuff in between it, right?
Like, I think that's absolutely right, and it's true for the older history as well. So, you know, historians write about the Seven Years' War as the kind of first global war, and it's 7 years. So they discuss what happened in those 7 years, and then we get the revolutions, the American, the Haitian, the French revolutions, the other big events, then the Napoleonic Wars. So you can kind of march through looking at these major events, and it does tend to filter out all of this other violence that is ongoing and that also is leading to these conflagrations, right? You really cannot understand any of those wars without understanding the patterns of violence that occur before those major wars take place. So that is a perspective change that I think is salutary.
And, you know, I'm keeping an eye on the time, and I wanted to, you know, we spend a lot of time talking about violence in war. I mean, it's in the book, so, you know, but the other part of the book that's critical is peace, right? And you introduce this notion of hyperviolent peace, and that's just been, like, really on my mind ever since I read the words. So I want to give you an opportunity to kind of talk about that idea of hyperviolent peace, because I think any person kind of coming in touch with that term, obviously there's a paradox in there, right? So let's talk about that a little bit.
It is I think useful to think about, and I call that kind of long 19th century phase a global order of armed peace. The notion is that empires were militarized, they were globally militarized, they were arming navies and sending out, forming new armed forces on land to, and they had a kind of idea of policing this space, that they were sending out these forces on patrol. They had standing authorization to engage in violence. And why do they engage in violence? Well, they have standing authorization to engage in, again, small violence. It's supposed to be limited. It's not supposed to start major wars. But but they're given carte blanche to do this to protect imperial subjects or protect imperial interests, and sometimes to protect something even vaguer, which is some kind of notion of imperial order or order on the edges of empires. And there was a lot of violence done in this kind of policing mode. Again, it's policing, the idea of patrolling. It's somewhere on the edge between war and peace. It's somewhere on the edge between interpolitical action and an intra-political action. Right? But it's very much this vision that that's what the violence is for, that it's to preserve peace and create order, that begins to be articulated very clearly by empires. And then, you know, there are some similarly not great results of this. In some cases, as you can imagine, there's quite a lot of arbitrary decision-making about who's going to be punished. And part of the book talks about the way these British Navy captains in the 19th century were sent out with these instructions, and they had to make these decisions based on, you know, some kind of investigation, some kind of on-the-spot determination of who was responsible for something or who deserved punishment. And so there's this kind of greatly arbitrary feel to the regime of violence in this kind of regime of armed peace. It's supposed to be peace. It's supposed to be orderly. But there's this bubbling of small violence throughout it. And then there are more spectacular kinds of violence phases that occur when these protection emergencies, as I call them, accumulate and become the justification for major wars. That justification is very much still with us. And I cannot help but think about Putin's descriptions of the justification for the invasion of Ukraine, which is very imperial in its language and in its logic, where he says, well, we just have to protect these ethnic Russians, and we are being provoked by the violence of Ukraine. And we're being, in effect, he says, we're being dragged in, forced into this war. And he says, it's not really a war. It's a special military operation. So it's very helpful, I think, to see that as part and parcel of this much longer regime of claims about armed peace that empires are creating.
Yeah, he's definitely a monster for the books, but not a unique monster.
No,
right? Like, not unique at all in any respect. And yeah, you know, you get caught up in this doublespeak, and I think that's one of the things that really interests me about all of this, right, is that the language is so blatantly doublespeak to be absurd, but yet we all agree that there's this tacit agreement that we're just going to pretend that these things all make sense. And you know, I want to get us out on this, because if I fall into a Putin wormhole, I will never extract myself from it. But he is a monster. In a world of monsters. In your mind, you know, since, you know, mentioning something like Ukraine and Putin opens up, and we've kind of gone back and forth a little bit to the times that we live in, do you think that it's easier now to have these small wars in a world where, you know, the weapons are more technological in their makeup, meaning that extreme violence can be enacted from much further away? And I would make an argument that the technology in which we fight wars looks different. There's cybersecurity wars, you know, I include the war on drugs, and you know, this idea of narco-terrorism as a way that, you know, particularly the West funnels money to despots under the guise of fighting terrorism and narcotics as a way of having war. Is it easier to obscure all of this with all these little categories and the pressing of drone buttons and, you know, all of those things? Does it make it easier to obscure the truth, or does it just give us more opportunity to highlight how much of this violence is happening. Or maybe it's a combination of both. I don't know. I can go back and forth, but I'm asking you.
Well, I mean, you see it. I think some other people see it too, right? You see that the war on drugs is an open-ended invitation to waves of small violence. And I suggest in the book that there are continuities in this long history of imperial violence also to the war on terror and to drone warfare. I'm quite interested to see where this goes. I do think there are interested is the wrong word because I'm also frightened. But
yeah. Is horrified a better word?
Yes. I was reflecting on this the other day, though. I think there are continuities in imperial warfare and drone warfare, but there could be something quite new around the corner as drone warfare becomes even more ubiquitous than it is. Again, I do think that keeping an eye on the history is helpful to be able to analyze what's happening. And I hope that you know others agree with me. But it is possible that we'll be moving into a new phase of some kind soon. I just don't know what it is.
Doesn't feel good, though.
No, it does not. No, it does not.
that we share in common. But, you know, there's one of the best rappers in my mind, Andre 3000. He has this line on a very early Outkast album where he says, "They got some stuff to blow out your back from where they stay at." You know, which is a line that even when I first heard it in like 1997, it's from their second album. That line always stuck with me because it's become truer than ever. They got some stuff to blow out your back from where they stay at. And there's, you don't need the aircraft carrier. You don't need the troops on the ground. You just need this buzzing thing to come over. And it's like focused. But as focused as they're also like terrible, terribly wrong when they kill so many civilians. It's a awful thing.
And I do make the analogy in the book because I think it is a useful analogy that in drone warfare, very similar to what I just described for British ships on the sea in the 19th century, you have to authorize people to attack the target. And that kind of level of authorization of violence really creates opportunities, not just for mistakes, but for really unregulated patterns of violence and waves of violence to occur. So I hope we can at least keep an eye on some of these things and try to figure out a way forward. In a way, I think for me, the message of the book for my own self-reflection is that in every era, people have struggled, sometimes in very sincere ways, with trying to limit violence. And yet we have very poor tools to do that. That's been something that's been sobering to think about. And I think it will continue to be a part of the human condition.
Yeah, gotta keep our eyes open. We gotta get out in the streets. We gotta keep these people accountable, right? I am definitely not for drones killing innocent people and destroying weddings and all the rest of it. Let's put a complete stop to all of that, you know, on a not so happy conversation, but very, very important, very, very important conversation. So I already told you we're not going to do off the dome, right? So there's no off the dome, but we are going to do the drop. And the drop is just an opportunity to share anything at all with my listeners. And my drop, which I'm sure over the almost 5 years that I've been doing this show, I've given it before, but I feel like I haven't given it in a long time. But I'm in the middle of a rewatch of one of my favorite shows. It's, to me, a top five show in the so-called golden era of TV, and it's called Deadwood. And it was on HBO, so now you can see it on HBO Max. I refuse to call that Max because that's a stupid brand. So it will always be either HBO or HBO Max to me. And every time I rewatch the show, which I've done now quite a few times, it astounds me as to the beauty of their language. It is an incredibly vulgar show. So for those who have not seen it, the language is incredibly vulgar, but also so deeply poetic and beautiful, which sounds like, again, they should be in conflict with one another. But if you think you understand who villains are in the human condition, definitely watch this show. It is a deeply human story of flawed characters who try to do, sometimes don't try to do the right thing. Oftentimes they're doing the wrong thing, but for right reasons. But it's a great show. And it's called Deadwood, 3 seasons. And then there was a movie. Movie was just meh to me, but I feel like I got to go back and rewatch the movie. I don't think I gave it its just due, but that is my drop, Deadwood.
I have not seen Deadwood, so I thank you for that.
You should definitely watch it.
I will.
Get past the vulgarity and let it and sit with it. But it's an amazing, amazing show. Believe me, you would get it. And so your drop.
So my drop is this book that appears in the epigraph of my book and then occasionally elsewhere in the book. And that is a novel by a guy named Nick Harkaway called The Gone Away World. And he's the one who came up with this phrase, hyperviolent piece, that you liked so well. But it is a quirky, interesting, kind of wild novel about a society that's dedicated to keeping this distant war distant. But it's war that's just allowed to occur or able to occur along a pipeline. It's a really wild book, but it's also peculiarly fun because it's got some interesting characters in it, and it gives you a way to think about this problem of keeping war away and how that problem just filters into everyday society and to even the love life of the characters. It's a really, really interesting novel.
Sounds like now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's timeless.
It's a flawed novel. It falls apart a little bit as it goes, but it is really worth reading.
Yeah, yeah. Every day I get a little older, so I'm falling apart as I go, but I'm still here. Lauren, this was a great conversation. Again, the book is called, they called it Peace, Worlds of Imperial Violence. Lauren, it was amazing having you join me on the deep dive. This was so much fun. And I use that term seriously because even though the book has a lot of like serious and heavy things in it, I think it's imperative for all of us as citizens of the world to engage with this type of history, so we can get to not a hyperviolent peace, but a peace. So let's aim for that. So thank you so much for joining me on the deep dive.
Thanks so much for having me, and here's to peace. So I really appreciate the chance to talk about the book. Thanks again.
Thank you so much.
You can listen to the deep dive via Apple Podcasts and our website, thedeepdivepod.com. Download, subscribe, listen, and share. If you like what you're hearing and enjoy what me and the team are putting together, then leave us a review. We'd love to hear from you. You can follow me on Twitter via @farflungphil. To all my listeners, wherever you are in the world, I thank you. See you on the other side.